afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
There are two issues to present to the court today. The first being whether the Superior Court abused its discretion by admitting evidence of other sexual contact by the defendant with the victim, Shania Hayman, and that those acts were admitted pursuant to Rule 404B. The second issue is whether the Superior Court abused its discretion by refusing to interview a juror whom had expressed that the investigating officer in the case was a guardian angel, and that essentially his credibility was unassailable. In either case, the remedy that we're asking for is remand for a new trial. First of all, dealing with the 404B issues, Mr. Barnett was arrested on the same day, May 14, 2003, that Shania Hayman gave a statement to Detective Zerba of the Newcastle County Police, indicating that there had been a pattern of sexual contact by Mr. Mark Barnett with her, actually beginning as early as 1992, although ultimately the only charges taken to trial were between the periods of December 1998 and May 2002. Four of the six charges ultimately taken to the jury, the indictment contained eight, but the state entered nolle prosequi on two of those counts on the morning of the first day of trial. But of the other charges, four alleged sexual conduct during the time period when Ms. Hayman would have been 13 to 16 years old.
That type of conduct would have been a violation of what statute?
Specifically, Your Honor, the first two counts of the indictment indicated rape first degree, or charged rape first degree, for sexual intercourse with a person under the age of 16. By a person who was in either in a position of authority or had, essentially a person in a position of authority or had the permission of, in this case, the mother to exercise authority over the child. The other two counts were rape in the second degree.
I'm speaking of the uncharged sexual conduct that you're referring to that was introduced.
I apologize.
That would have been a violation of what set of statutes if it had been indicted?
It would have been three additional charges of rape first degree, and as the victim testified, it would have been lots of other occasions. She was not more specific when there was a sexual contact, that is, touching by Mr. Barnett of her genitalia.
So the total, there were six other incidents, right?
Well, there were three for sure, and the victim was not more specific than to say that the touching happened lots of times when he would come into her bedroom at night. And that was precisely the testimony that was offered. Initially, the state, through Mr. Cherniff, had indicated there would be 20 to 40 other incidents that would be introduced. And the argument from the state initially was that this was indicted conduct because it all happened between December of 98 and May of 2002. The trial judge would not permit the conduct to be testified about in that way, saying that, holding quite clearly that the defendant had a right to know what conduct would constitute each of the charges that the state was going forward on, as opposed to simply throwing in references generally to many other acts during that period of, if I count correctly, 3.5 years. actually, yes, 3.5 years. The state then sought to admit this, these prior bad acts, through use of Rule 404B. Specifically telling the court on many occasions that the reason for doing this was that the prior acts would tend to establish intent. And of course, as this court has said, both in Getz and in many cases since then, the purpose of Rule 404B is that if there is an ultimate fact, such as intent, that is at issue in the case, the state may introduce evidence of other bad acts, either prior or actually subsequent also. And the state may do that in its case in chief, as it did here, if it anticipates, reasonably anticipates, that this will be an issue, and makes a specific proffer of relevancy. Now, the prosecutor in this case told the trial judge, and remember, the context of this is that it was not brought to the judge's attention until immediately before jury selection. So the judge struggled first with whether these could come in as indicted conduct during the 3.5-year period, ultimately ruling they could not. Jury was selected, and the attorneys then met again with the judge to discuss Getz analysis, and trial began immediately thereafter. So intent was the only proffer made by the state, even though Mr. Barnett had never indicated that there was any issue of mistake or accident, that there had been some contact that could have been construed as sexual but in fact was not. There was never any question about who the identity of the perpetrator was. Mr. Barnett was clearly identified by the victim, and the defense in the case was simply these incidents did not occur. This court in Getz dealt with precisely the same scenario. Factually, it's almost indistinguishable. If you recall, the Getz case involved sexual contact between a defendant and his minor daughter. And there were allegations, as here, of rape in the first degree and other sexual offenses. And this court made it clear in that decision that, first of all, it was not going to recognize any kind of sexual gratification exception under Rule 404B. Because it fails the materiality test, but also that evidence of other similar sexual contact did not in any way go to prove intent. Intent, of course, under the statute, 11 Del Code Section 231, is something that is proven when the jury believes, after hearing all of the facts, that it was the defendant's conscious object on each occasion charged to commit the acts alleged. So that, as this court had said, there is no need for other prior bad acts to prove intent. In fact, they don't prove intent in any way, since the issue of intent is confined to what happened on each of the separate occasions. The problem that a person in Mr. Barnett's position has, and he certainly had in this case, is that these other acts are not defined as to time or place, except that they occurred either within a 2.5-year period or, well, actually within a 3-year period from 98 to 01, or within a 5.5-month period after the young lady had turned 16. He's not told that what the specifics of even the indicted charges are initially, much less that the state has any intent of bringing in what could have been a plethora, 20 to 40, as the prosecutor said, other incidents that really are not material to the jury's consideration of whether or not the sexual contact happened on these 6 occasions alleged. The harm, I think, I needn't be too long or specific about, because it's clear that the harm to the defendant is, first of all, it engenders sympathy for the victim. That she is not only a person who says that she was touched or forced to perform a sexual act on 6 occasions, but on many, many other occasions, that it was an ongoing victimization. It may also serve in the jury's mind to bolster the credibility of this victim, in the sense that she is telling a tale that occurred not occasionally, but often. How could anyone make up so much?
Can I ask you, the defense you said was that this just didn't happen, right?
Yes.
And was that bolstered, if you will, by specifics of, she alleges that this conduct took place on Thursday at 4 o'clock, but at Thursday at 4 o'clock I can show you that I was at McDonald's and here's the receipt from McDonald's. I mean,
nothing that specific, Your Honor. The trial judge did, before the opening statements to the jury, did instruct the state to tell the defense and the court also on the record what the allegation was as to each of these charges. And the prosecutor did that after talking again with the victim. And she was unable to give dates, except that she was able to describe one incident of alleged rape that occurred at the A.I. DuPont Institute when she was there with Mr. Barnett and her mother cleaning. And that was a job that they did in the evening. And she did testify that she and Mr. Barnett were alone in a bathroom and that he essentially sexually attacked her there, forced her to perform oral copulation.
But in terms of his defense, even to that specific one, did he claim to have some alibi in terms of I was somewhere else or something like that?
Well, he claimed, of course, that he was at A.I. DuPont because they did go there. She came sometimes with Mr. Barnett and Ms. Heyman's mother. But through his own testimony, he said it just never happened. He also presented the testimony of Ms. Heyman's mother, Karen McClendon Heyman, who testified that the two of them were not on the occasion that she alleged. And she was able to estimate, I think, by year, perhaps. But the mother testified they were just never alone in the bathrooms during the times that they would be there cleaning.
All right, well, what I'm trying to get to is the question of whether there was real prejudice from the additional comments made by the victim that were allowed under the prior, the intent ruling. It's not as if we're talking about evidence that your client committed these acts with somebody else also, which I think surely would be prejudicial. You've got the one victim who's either going to be believed or not going to be believed. How does the fact that she testifies that there were other incidents like this cause any additional prejudice beyond the prejudice that she's testifying that this happened at all?
Well, I did refer to the fact that it probably engenders more sympathy for the victim, something the trial judge recognized on the record, may tend to bolster her credibility in the eyes of the jurors. But we also have the fact that Mr. Barnett can't defend himself against it. For instance, with other acts allegedly occurred when the whole family was asleep in Ms. Heyman's home, Mr. Barnett did not live there. He had a brief relationship with the victim's mother when he was separated from his wife in 1991-92, and because a child resulted, there continued to be some relationship. But Ms. Heyman was not related to him at all. Mr. Barnett and his wife, Tierney Dubard, both testified that never, since they had reconciled in 1992, had he ever on any occasion stayed overnight at that home of the victim's mother. The three siblings of Ms. Heyman, who lived in the home, all testified. They were ages 16, 14, and 12, testified that Mr. Barnett never stayed overnight on any occasion. The other specifics, such as the victim testifying that on one of the occasions she was in an upstairs bedroom in the home, that there were other family members about, including her mother, who was right across a hall. And she testified specifically how this incident occurred and that her mother actually came into the room, but she somehow was able to hide it. They were specific enough that those instances could be attacked either through cross-examination by attempting to elicit detail that simply the witness couldn't give, or through the defense case itself, through Mr. Barnett, through Ms. Dubard, his wife, or through the mother, Karen McClendon Heyman. So,
well, isn't there also an issue of notice here? Was it your client, as I understand it, was arrested on one count of rape one, two counts of rape one count of unlawful sexual contact second. So he's arrested on three charges, and then he was indicted on eight charges.
Yes.
And now you're saying additional charge, three additional rapes, and up to 40 more sexual contacts. When was that first notice of those given?
Well, after completion of discovery, Your Honor, and a little more than a month before trial, in early November of 2003, the trial commenced December 9th, trial counsel, Mr. Benson, filed a motion for a bill of particulars because he had been speaking with the prosecutor trying to identify the the specifics of any acts that the state intended to introduce. Certainly, of the 8 indicted charges, the prosecution refused, and thus the motion was filed. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, it was not dealt with until the morning of the first day of trial. But only on that morning of the first day was trial counsel placed on notice of the state's intent to introduce other acts other than the 8 indicted, which was, as I said, reduced to 6 at that time. And unfortunately, as the court is aware, there is no state rule which requires notice of the state's intent to use 404B evidence, unlike the federal rule on the federal practice. So that both defense counsel and the court had to deal with this issue on the fly, so to speak, without the opportunity to consider in advance and research and deal with this troublesome issue. Another problem, and Justice Berger, you mentioned prejudice to the defendant. Another problem that the defendant has is that, and this was recognized by the trial judge, she specifically mentioned in the transcript, I think it's around page 28, I could give a specific page if the court would like, but recognize that simply letting the state willy-nilly introduce general testimony about other bad acts may well have the kind of influence on the jury that we all want to avoid, which causes undue prejudice to a defendant. And that is where you have specific charges and general allegations by a victim of other acts that occurred. And a juror says, well, I have a little bit of problem with one of the elements, and I'm summarizing what Judge Jordan said. I'm having a little problem, say, with one of the elements on count one, that rape first degree, but gee, the victim testified that this happened 3 other times, so you know, that helps me get over the hump of reasonable doubt that I have on the specifics of that particular charge. And so I'm comfortable in finding the defendant guilty. This is something that the trial judge repeated on several occasions, that she wanted to avoid a situation where a jury may unfairly and improperly accumulate evidence, pulling a fact here and a fact there to say, well, it looks like it must have happened at least on 2 occasions, and reaching a verdict of guilty without specifically feeling that it must see each of the elements as described in the charge clearly for each of these separate incidents.
We usually take some comfort in the fact that in the close case, the trial judge will give the jury a cautionary instruction that reaffirms to them how they're supposed to sort their way through this. What happened here?
The judge did give a 404B limiting instruction. And the way it occurred actually goes to part of the state's response to this argument, that even that testimony of these other acts was inextricably intertwined with the victim's testimony of the indicted acts. As it happened, and clearly in the transcript, the prosecutor walked the victim through each of the 6 remaining counts to testify about what happened, and then advised the court, I'm going to get into the 404B, the other bad acts. The court gave the limiting instruction, which was repeated in the instructions to the jury at the end of the case. And only then did the prosecutor, without reference to any of the 6 incidents already testified to, had the victim testify that there were oral copulation on 3 other occasions without any greater detail. And that.
And you're saying the record reflects that the state had completed its case on the 6 indicted charges?
Yes, Your Honor.
Presented its proof on all 6 charges and then continued to present evidence that there were other charges.
That is exactly what happened, Your Honor. And again, Your Honors, if I may, just going back to this court's decision in Getz, I'm unable to get past the very clear and precise language in that decision that under no circumstances may the state, in its case in chief, introduce these types of prior bad acts where they do not reasonably anticipate that a material issue, as such as intent, is going to be raised by the defense. And again, that the Getz decision's very clear indication that intent was not a proper basis, was not a proper issue in a case exactly like this one.
So a Getz analysis on the facts of Getz necessarily results in an exclusion of the evidence.
And yes, Your Getz said. That's my position, that under the very first element in the Getz analysis, it fails. Although the trial court ruled otherwise, I believe that looking at it closely and looking at the facts of the Getz case, you cannot reach that conclusion correctly, that these acts should have been excluded. I should mention also there was indication that introduction of these bad acts, even if it were error, if the trial court abused its discretion, that it could constitute harmless error. And I think that referring primarily to this court's recent decision in the Capano case, where you dealt at length with harmless error, what it is instructive. And if I may just briefly, the court in that case indicated that the harmless error standard in a non-constitutional issue such as this would be whether the putative error likely to have had substantial injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict. The court formulated it and adopted also a somewhat different formulation, which I personally prefer because of its clarity, which the court took from U.S. v. Zerbach, cited in the Capano case, a Third Circuit decision en banc, where an error was deemed to be harmless when it is highly probable, and that was emphasized in the formulation by the Third Circuit, when it was highly probable that the error did not contribute to the judgment. In this case, we have one person saying that these six acts occurred. We don't have any corroboration of that. Although the state presented six witnesses, one of them, Detective Zerba, simply repeated what the victim had told him during the interview on the same day of Mr. Barnett's arrest. The other witnesses testified that the victim had reported these incidents as having occurred, first in May of 2002 to several people, including her own mother, and to her father and a friend, a school friend, in May of 2003, just shortly before the arrest and charges. Is it highly probable that these prior bad acts permitting them in contributed to the judgment? I think so, not only for all the reasons that I've already stated, but this was clearly not a case, as this court found in Capano, where there was no viable defense, or where the defense, at least on that point, was incredible, if you will. The extent to which the victim's allegations are contradicted in a reasonable or plausible defense is an element in deciding whether or not this error was harmless. It is a close case, and these prior bad acts could have been enough to tip the jury toward conviction. The jury did not convict on all of the indicted charges. The two rape second-degree charges, the jury brought in verdicts of guilt on the lesser-included offenses of unlawful sexual contact second degree. And on one of the counts of rape fourth degree, they brought back a verdict of guilty of unlawful sexual contact in the third degree. So there was clearly a good deal for the jury to chew on. And as I said, permitting this evidence may have been enough for them to accumulate incidents, bolstering the credibility of the victim, and thereby reaching a verdict of guilt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll address the first issue that's been addressed this afternoon, but if there's any questions on the second issue that was briefed, that has to do with the conduct of various jurors. I'll certainly try to answer those as well. There was no abuse of discretion by the trial judge in admitting the other uncharged crimes evidence under Delaware Rule of Evidence 404B here. What the trial judge did was correctly apply the six-step analytical paradigm that this court laid out in Getz, as well as applying the nine factors of DeShields in performing the balancing test under 403 of the Rule of Evidence. The six factors, the trial judge found that evidence of these other three alleged sexual assaults that were not indicted was material to an ultimate issue in the case. Secondly, that this evidence was being introduced, the other uncharged crimes evidence was being introduced for a proper purpose, that is, to show the defendant's intent. The trial judge
Could you explain how those prior bad acts go to intent?
Well, I think it's an element of the offense. You have to show that this is intentional conduct. And I think it's similar to what this court decided in 96 in Vanderhoff. And Vanderhoff was a case that was also dealing with sexual assaults against a minor complaining witness. There was evidence of an earlier incident where the accused had shined a flashlight on the vaginal area of the complaining witness, which was approximately 8 years old. The conduct that he was on trial for, however, dealt with later incidents. This court in Vanderhoff held that that was evidence of intent, that he wasn't doing some other thing with a flashlight. He wasn't examining the child for an injury or something like that, that it was intended to be a sexual contact or something sexual in nature. And I think that's the same reasoning that's applied here as to why it's indicative of intent.
How is this case indistinguishable from Getz?
How is it distinguishable? Well, I think it's distinguishable because and I think the other side, Mr. Barnett, reads Getz a little too restrictively. I think the problem in Getz was not that other conduct was admitted, but the trial judge had abused his discretion in not going through a correct analysis. And what was done in Getz was to specifically lay out six steps that a trial judge should follow. We've come to refer to that in shorthand as a Getz analysis before admitting this type of evidence. And I think Getz, in a broader respect...
Let me read you this quote from Getz that's in Mr. Ahern's brief. It says, "Thus, whereas here the state presents direct evidence through the testimony of an alleged victim that an attack occurred, no evidential purpose is served by proof that the defendant committed other intentional criminal acts of the same type." So, as I understand Mr. Ahern's characterization of the record, the state was able to establish these other six incidents as standalone criminal activities.
Yes, the witness testified to that.
And so then the question is, why are these other acts admissible if the state had already established the elements of the six charged offenses?
Well, I think they're admissible under 404B because they're additional evidence of intent. The trial prosecutor, when the issue initially arose at the beginning of trial, had argued two bases for admission. One was that...
Well, let me... You're talking about intent. This quote I read you from Getz said that no evidential purpose is served by proof that the defendant committed other intentional criminal acts. So, how do we distinguish that language in Getz in this case?
Well, I think it's the same way that it must have been distinguished either explicitly or implicitly in Vanderhoff, which was decided after Getz. And in that case, it wasn't subsequent conduct, it was actually earlier conduct, but it was the same principle of other uncharged crimes that it can be admissible.
The quote from Getz is, other intentional criminal acts of the same type. So if we look at the subsequent case, we already have one distinguishing feature in that it's different conduct. Here, we're talking about the same type of conduct.
Well, some of it is certainly the same. The first-degree rape charges are the same, and I think there were two of those allegations. There were other charges dealing with lesser crimes. But I think if you read Getz in that way, it's never going to be admissible. But that is certainly contrary to other precedent of this court saying that this type of evidence, other uncharged crime evidence, can be admissible to prove intent. There's the Joyner case that talked about an apple core, and there's a case called Kendall, which had to deal with some home improvement frauds, and there's a case, a much earlier case called Patterson.
Why was intent an issue in this case after the six charged crimes had been established?
Well, I think it was still an issue because you never know what the defense is going to present. It's an element of the offense, so it has to be proven in the case in chief by the state. You never know if the defendant is or isn't going to take the stand. Ultimately, he did not take the stand here, but the state doesn't know that during the presentation of its case in chief.
So are you saying that in the Getz case itself, because it was remanded for a new trial, that the evidence that resulted in the reversal, if it had just, the trial judge had just gone through those six factors, it could have been admitted at the retrial?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the trial judge obviously would have had to exercise his independent discretion. And that, I think, was the real broader holding of Getz, was that the evidence was simply allowed to come in without a proper analysis. There wasn't the balancing test performed. There wasn't determinations of materiality. There wasn't determinations under the applicable rule of evidence as to why it could be admitted. There has to be determinations. If it's too remote in time, then it shouldn't be admitted too. So none of those determinations had been made in the first instance in Getz. Whether ultimately it would have come in or not, I don't know. That's for the trial judge to make the ruling. Well, then it ultimately didn't. But I think we're looking at Getz now years and years later, and the broader holding, and I think the proper holding of Getz, is that the trial judge has to thoughtfully go through these steps. And we've also added some other factors in the DeShields decision when you're talking about the 403 balancing test. And Judge Jordan very carefully did all of that in this case. And that was her decision. And ultimately, this court reviews that for an abuse of discretion.
Assuming for the moment that the court disagrees and finds that it was an abuse of discretion to allow the uncharged crimes, tell us why that would be harmless error.
Well, I think it's harmless error for at least a couple of reasons. One is that if you look at the ultimate verdict in this case, if you assume that this evidence was so damaging to Mr. Barnett that he was being deprived of his right to a fair trial because the jury's going to simply assume that he's a bad person, that he's predisposed to committing the crimes that are alleged here, the proof of that is not found in the jury verdict. The jury verdict, he's convicted of three of the offenses as indicted, but on the other three indicted charges, he's found guilty of a lesser included offense of sexual contacts. If you would assume that the jury from the other uncharged crimes evidence was making this assumption, he's a bad person, he has to have done all this because he's predisposed to this type of conduct, the more logical result you would expect from the jury is that he would have been found guilty of all six offenses as charged.
Those other three, the state hadn't reduced the charges?
No, they produced some evidence, but the evidence was, or the jury determined anyway, that the evidence only established unlawful sexual contacts. I think two of them were second degree and one was a third degree unlawful sexual contact.
Right. What I was asking was whether the state had reduced the charges that were presented to the jury on those other counts.
Oh, excuse me. No, they hadn't reduced them. They had nulli pros two of the original eight, and they only went to trial on six. They got convictions as charged on three of the six and got guilty verdicts as to lesser included offenses on the other three. So I think if you're looking at this from a harmless error or prejudice analysis, you can't show that he was absolutely prejudiced to the extent that he was deprived of a fair trial, that the jury was assuming he's predisposed. Because
Mr. Ahern argues that if the jury was leading his way a little bit by the fact that he was found guilty of these lesser included offenses, and they might have found him not guilty, but for the introduction of the other bad acts.
Well, I mean, that's the counter argument, but I think the question that was asked on the earlier argument, and I think Justice Berger asked the question as well, this was a case of, she said this, happened, he denies it, although he didn't take the stand, but he presented defense witnesses. It was simply denial that any of this occurred. So it was a case of the jury's either going to believe the complaining witness or they're not. Is it more probable that the jury is going to believe the complaining witness if she testifies to one incident, six incidents, or nine incidents? The trial judge, in doing her analysis here, pointed out that whatever unfair prejudice there might be in adding additional uncharged crimes evidence was relatively minimal in this case, that the jury had already heard what the allegations were, that he was charged with having committed sexual assaults against a minor. She was between the ages of 13 and 16 when these things all occurred, or when most of the charges occurred. So whatever shock value there was, that had already been introduced when the indictment was read to the jury. That the mere fact that the witness, the complaining witness, testifies to three additional incidents that are uncharged does not so tip the balance that there is unfair prejudice to the accused.
Do you agree that the three additional uncharged instances were of rape in the first degree?
Yes, they would all have been first degree rape charges.
Of which the defendant received notice on the morning of trial?
I think that's how it occurred. That's when all the colloquies occurred with the trial prosecutor. Yes, it was the morning of the first day of trial. There was a preliminary discussion. I think then there was a lunch and recess. After the lunch and recess, everybody reassembled. I think the trial judge heard some additional, more abbreviated comments from counsel and then made her ruling at that point.
That notice, I take it, the state thought was adequate since the defendant did them all anyway and had to know about them, right?
Well, I assume that's one of the arguments, is that...
It's only one that comes to mind. What else would justify that notice?
If you did it, you should know it, whether you did it or you didn't know it. So how are you so unfairly prejudiced? And I think the other questions directed to the nature of the defense are apropos, too. Would it have all have changed the defense that was presented? No, it wouldn't have. So any error, if there was error, has to be harmless in this particular instance, because the defense was simply, I didn't do any of this. It doesn't matter what she says and how many accusations she makes, I didn't do any of this. And he did present defense witnesses testifying to the fact that, you know, some of these things were just highly unlikely to have occurred, given the living arrangements at the particular household where most of these incidents occurred. There was one incident, I think, at the AI DuPont Institute where the mother, the accused, and the complaining witness were all three doing cleaning after hours at the hospital.
What's your view of the role of the nature and role of the cautionary or limiting instruction that the trial judge gave in this case?
Well, I think it's certainly appropriate. It's required under Getz, and what the trial judge did here was, before any of these three other uncharged crimes incidents were introduced, any evidence of those, the trial judge did give a limiting instruction. That instruction was repeated 2 days later in the final instructions. The jury is presumed to follow the trial judge's instructions, and if you look at the limiting instruction, it simply tells the jury the limited purpose for which the evidence is being introduced, that they're not to assume that this is a reflection of general propensity evidence, and that the person is predisposed to have committed the other crimes that are being charged in the case. So I think here the trial judge did everything that she should have done. There were limiting instructions here. Ultimately, if there was any error, I think it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the jury verdict in this particular case. And as has been pointed out, it didn't really affect the defense one way or another in this particular instance. And the fact that the complaining witness is testifying as to one, six, or nine events ultimately is not going to redound so to the detriment of the accused as being deprived of his right to a fair trial.
And with regard to these other three uncharged crimes, didn't the victim present enough testimonial evidence that if he had been charged, he could have been convicted of those charges based on her testimony?
Yes, I think so. It was more general in nature. She was asked questions about how often did these incidents of oral intercourse occur, and I think her testimony was five or six. And then when the investigating police officer testified to her prior statement, a 3507 statement, I think his testimony was similar, that she had said there were five or six such occasions, and given her age at that particular time and the relationship that Mr. Barnett was to this individual, that they all would have qualified as first-degree rape charges. So I think, you know, that was all in the mix at that particular time.
Can you tell us why he wasn't indicted on these three additional rape firsts?
Well, I don't know. I think probably given the argument that the prosecutor was making, he was also making an alternative argument about the evidence being inextricably intertwined. I think there was some concern as to what the testimony was going to be from the child complaining witness when she got on the stand. I think given the way that the testimony came out and that she was able to segment it into two general areas, that she probably did a whole lot better than the prosecutor anticipated. That there was a little confusion, I think, on some of her testimony about times or whatever, but she was able to testify relatively straightforward and categorically about each of the incidents. So I think, you know, that was probably a concern in how it was being indicted. The other thing is, I guess, just a practical concern here, if he's convicted of two of these first-degree rape charges.
When the state presented its case on the sixth charge, defenses, and it completed its presentation on those six, was there any doubt that any of the six were intentional?
No, I don't think there would have been.
There, I hope, was no tactical concern that life would be a lot easier for me as a prosecutor if I indicted on six, but could get three others unindicted, because A, I wouldn't have to give notice until the morning of trial to the defense about the other three, but I could make the inextricably intertwined argument and get the three unindicted ones that I don't have to prove in to evidence before the jury, and it'll work for me in convicting on the other six. So I can add three charges without actually having to prove them and facilitate my ability to convict on the six, which combined is an interminable number of years with a maximum penalty anyway. Tell me that wasn't a part of the tactical concern of the state.
Well, I don't think it was a tactical concern, because the defense would know what it was that the accused had alleged here, that she was making these statements that the incidents of first-degree rape had occurred on five or six occasions. That was her statement to the investigating officer. That was the substance of the allegations. Now, when the state sifted through it and decided what they reasonably felt comfortable in indicting and attempting to prove at trial, they only charged two of those matters. So I think that was the sifting process, that notice would have been given through discovery of the accusations made by the complaining witness here. It's not a total surprise on the day of trial.
What's your response to the suggestion that there was a motion for a bill of particulars, but the bill of particulars wasn't answered, and why it wasn't answered?
I don't really know that. I didn't realize that till I had heard that today, and I don't know why it wasn't answered till the day of trial. I mean, I think if the defense felt they needed additional specificity and that hadn't been addressed before, probably the most appropriate thing for the defense would do would be to ask for a continuance, because for whatever reasons that motion hadn't been presented.
It's correct that when one receives a motion for a bill of particulars, one responds to it, right?
Yes, I think you have 10 days, I believe.
And then does it get scheduled if you don't deliver the response, if you don't deliver the actual bill of particulars?
Well, I don't know if the defense has to take an additional step to move to compel or not. I mean, they may have to do that to bring it to a trial judge's attention.
Well, do you know in this case whether the state responded at all to the motion for a bill of particulars?
I don't know if they did. I'm assuming, because the representations that have been made, that they did not. I don't know why that didn't happen. But again, I think
if they had not responded at all, and the period of time to respond goes by, wouldn't the natural assumption be that they were going to respond, they just didn't get around to it in a timely way?
Well, I think that's probably the correct assumption, that for whatever reason, you know, somebody just hadn't come to grips with it and addressed it, and then suddenly it's the day of trial.
But here, ultimately, given the verdict that was returned by the jury in this case, and given the nature of the offense, excuse me, given the nature of the defense, there wasn't any ultimate prejudice here, even if the trial judge was incorrect in allowing these three additional incidents to be introduced as uncharged crimes evidence in this case. If there's any additional questions about the first or the second argument, I'll certainly try to answer those.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel.
I had reserved 5 minutes. It did not show. That's fine.
I think you used it all up, according to the...
I hadn't realized that. My
apologies. This clock is never wrong when I started.
I started.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Hear me, hear me, hear me. All matters persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. Court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.